Uranus and Neptune. During antiquity, and until well into the 18th century, it was assumed that there were seven planets or wanderers: the Sun, the Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, after whom the days of the week were named. It was difficult to believe that this would ever change. The discovery of Uranus by William Herschel on March 13, 1781, had the surprising effect of utter novelty. The event broke with immemorial traditions and seemed to show astronomy as still young and full of unlooked-for possibilities. This event occurred at the close of a century noted for its development of calculus and celestial mechanics, which had succeeded in accounting for all observed complexities of planetary motion. It was a development that, moreover, through its demonstrated perfection, had suggested a degree of finality. Uranus was found to possess a nearly circular orbit at an average distance of 19 astronomical units from the Sun. This distance was comforting. It confirmed and extended the roughly exponential law of Titius-Bode of planetary distances from the Sun. The discovery of the next planet, Neptune, in 1846 was due not to accidental observation by an assiduous observer, but instead to brilliant theoretical prediction based on perturbations in the orbit of Uranus. The observed motion of the planet Uranus had been unexpected. It did not seem to follow gravitational theory. New data increasingly showed intolerable departures from Newtonian motion. The concept of irregularities being due to an unknown exterior body appears to date back to about 1830, but no precise predictions of its location were available until 1845 and 1846. These predictions led to the discovery of the disturbing body on September 23, 1846, by Galle of Berlin, who used the precise forecasts of position and brightness by Le Verrier of Paris. An independent parallel effort in England led to somewhat earlier observations, which, however, remained unreduced until after Galle's discovery had been announced. The discovery of Neptune led to repeated attempts later to extend the planetary system one more step. The discovery of Pluto at the Lowell Observatory in 1930 had been stimulated by such efforts, although the discovery itself by Tombaugh was an empirical result based on a well-conceived, very thorough photographic survey of most of the sky. Soon it was found that the mass of Pluto is too small to have caused appreciable effects on the observed positions of Uranus and Neptune. Pluto, in fact, appears to be a body that is not only much smaller in mass, but also different in composition from Uranus and Neptune. It resembles instead a large satellite, and it seems probable that Pluto was a satellite that escaped from Neptune during the early history of the solar system. This explanation is indicated by the strange nature of Pluto's orbit around the Sun, for it intersects the orbit of its neighbor, Neptune. Thus, Uranus and Neptune, by their large masses and nearly circular orbits, are the outermost objects now known having unquestioned planetary status. The effects of the discovery of Neptune on the reputation of science were profound. By it, the last lingering doubts as to the absolute exactness of Newtonian law were dissipated. Recondite analytical methods received confirmation, brilliant and intelligible, even to the minds of the vulgar, and emerged from the patient solitude of the study to enjoy an hour of clamorous triumph. So it was written at the time. Forever invisible to the unaided eye of man, a sister globe to our Earth was shown to circulate in perpetual frozen exile at 30 times its distance from the sun. This was written in the last century. The scientific significance of the planets, Uranus and Neptune, is heightened by the fact that both are attended by satellites. Uranus has 5 known satellites, 2 of which, Titania and Oberon, were discovered by William Herschel in 1787. 2, Ariel and Umbriel, by Lassell in 1851. And the 5th satellite, Miranda, by myself in 1947. All 5 satellites have orbits that are very nearly circular and are situated in the same plane, which at the same time is the plane of the planet's equator. This common plane is not, as one might have expected, nearly coincident with the planet's orbit around the sun, but instead is nearly vertically inclined to it. Thus, as the planet moves about the sun in its orbital period of 84 years, the satellite plane is seen edge-on from the sun and from the Earth on 2 occasions, 42 years apart. Such edge-on appearance occurred in 1966, last year, with the next occurrence about 2008. It is obviously a favorable occasion to measure the precise inclinations of the satellite orbits, as well as the oblateness of the planetary disk due to its rotation. Because no spots can be seen on the planet, the period of rotation must be ascertained spectroscopically by the Doppler shift of the reflected light observed along the planetary equator. In this manner, the observers at the Lowell Observatory found the period of rotation to be a little over 10 hours, or a little less than half a day. Interestingly, the period of rotation of Uranus is similar to that of the giant planets Jupiter, which is 9 hours and 50 minutes, or 0.4 days, and Saturn, which is 10.2 hours, or 0.43 days, 43 hundredths of a day, both measured at the equator. Jupiter and Saturn have a so-called equatorial acceleration, as is true for the Sun, meaning that the equatorial zones revolve somewhat more rapidly than do the higher latitudes. It is not known how this differential effect is maintained in these giant planets, nor is it known whether Uranus shares in this peculiar property, because its disk is too small and too dim to allow ready spectroscopic determination of this effect. Let us pause to consider this period of rotation of about 10 hours, common to the planets Uranus, Saturn, and Jupiter. This period is rather fast for bodies having such comparatively low mean densities. Jupiter's mean density is 1.3 times water, Saturn's only 0.7 times water, and Uranus 1.6 times water. Consider a set of planets whose mean densities are all equal to that of water, but whose periods of rotation vary in length. One finds that there is a limit below which the period cannot go. If the limit were surpassed, the centrifugal force at the equator would exceed the attractive force of gravity, and the equatorial material of the planet would fly off into space. For a planet of unit density, this limiting period is roughly 1/7 of a day, or 3.3 hours. For a planet of higher density, the limiting period is lower, decreasing inversely as the square root of the mean density. Thus, the rotational periods of the three planets are roughly 3 times as long as the absolute minimum compatible with stability. Because in the early period of planet formation, there are several mechanisms by which a forming planet can shed an excessive amount of rotational momentum and thereby lengthen its period of revolution, it is not unreasonable to assume that the three planets initially rotated considerably faster than at present, and that they are in fact approached the danger limit. These planets may thus have been surrounded by a disk-like or sheet-like gas cloud in which condensation took place. It is precisely this mechanism that is assumed to have given rise to the very symmetrical and flat satellite systems of these three planets and, in the case of Saturn, to its ring as well. Because the inner satellites of Saturn are better known than those of Uranus, owing to their greater brightness and their greater proximity to the Earth, I shall consider the Saturn system for purposes of general orientation. The masses of its inner satellites are quite well known, derived from gravitational perturbations of long periods that are evaluated from precise positional measurements. The diameters of the Saturn satellites can also be determined. I found them just measurable with a 200-inch Hale telescope. The mean densities can thus be computed, and for the inner two, Saturn satellites are found to be somewhat less than that of water. The colors of the satellites are white, and their reflectivity is exceedingly high, close to unity. Apparently, these bodies are composed largely of snows, derived from water and ammonia. The two bright rings of Saturn, called A and B, appear to be composed of snow also. This was found by myself in about 1948 from infrared reflection spectrum in several series of observations, several times confirmed since. Snow, while white to the eye, has substantial absorptions in the near infrared, beginning at about 1.5 microns. The thickness of the ring system is probably less than 1 meter, and actually probably around 10 centimeters, or 4 inches. The inner satellites of Saturn and the ring therefore resemble meteorological condensation products which formed in the original extended atmosphere of the planet. It is very probable that the same is true for the satellites of Uranus. These two are brilliant white, and their masses, known only approximately, are compatible with the hypothesis that they are composed largely of snows. The difference between the Saturn ring A and B and the Saturn satellites is merely that the rings formed inside the so-called Roche limit and the satellites outside this limit. The Roche limit is the distance from the planetary center, outside of which solid or liquid masses can combine under the influence of their mutual gravitation, and inside this limit, this is not possible, owing to the preponderance of the planetary tidal force, which keeps the masses apart. At the limit itself, the separating power of the planetary tidal force equals the mutual attraction of the two masses in contact. The location of the Roche limit depends on the bulk density of the condensate. If it equals that of the planet, the Roche limit is 2.4 planetary radii from the planet's center. If the condensate is less, the limit is farther out. Thus, our moon would break up by the tidal forces of the Earth if it came within 2.9 instead of 2.4 Earth radii from the center of the Earth. The Uranus satellites are outside the Roche limit of Uranus, which allow them to form. The outer edge of ring A of Saturn is 2.3 planetary radii away, and the first satellite, Mimas, 3.1 radii away. This indicates that the bulk density of the ring material is quite comparable to the density of the planet, or 0.7 times water. It could be slightly less, but not appreciably more. This is consistent with the previous conclusion about the consistency of the Saturn rings as snow. In other words, the Saturn rings may be regarded as composed of snowballs of a few inches, say 10 centimeters or so, in diameter, and a single flat layer of such snowballs. We have now reached a point of extraordinary interest for our general ideas on the formation of the planets and the satellite systems. Why is it that the planet Saturn has rings, but that none are found around Jupiter or Uranus? The presence of the Saturn ring and of Saturn's satellite system, beginning almost immediately outside the ring, shows that the flat disk of cosmic material extending beyond the Saturn equator was almost continuous from the planet itself out to 10 or even 20 planet radii. Were the original protoplanet disks of Jupiter and of Uranus constituted differently? The case of Jupiter, in this case, the absence of a snow ring can be understood. Jupiter is only about half the Saturn distance from the Sun, and therefore receives four times more solar energy per unit area. Snows have the interesting property of being very cold compared to silicates. They reflect about three quarters of the solar radiation received, but they are excellent emitters in the infrared so that they cool themselves by radiation to a temperature which is only about 80% from the absolute zero compared to silicates. Thus, the rings of Saturn should have a temperature of approximately 60 degrees above the absolute zero centigrade. At this very low temperature, the evaporation rate to a vacuum becomes excessively slow, almost imperceptible even during the long history of the solar system. The rings and the snow satellites of Saturn are just found to be essentially stable against evaporation losses. This would not be true at the distance of Jupiter. One can show that a thin ring, like Saturn's, would almost certainly have evaporated during geologic time. So that's why Jupiter does not have such a ring, cannot have such a ring. A further difference between Jupiter and Saturn appears to exist. The innermost of the four Galilean satellites of Jupiter has a density as high as four times water, with the other three satellites 3.8, 2.4, and 2.1, indicating that Jupiter was a powerful source of heat during the period of satellite formation. It is therefore quite probable that Jupiter at no time possessed a snow ring like Saturn's. These arguments, however, cannot apply to Uranus. This planet has twice the distance of Saturn, which would permit the preservation of a ring had it ever existed, while the smaller mass of Uranus compared to Saturn would have favored an even colder envelope. All we can say is that no such ring for Uranus has yet been found, and if present, must be exceedingly dim and rarefied compared to the ring of Saturn. While the planet Neptune itself has close similarities to the planet Uranus, as we shall see, the satellite system of Neptune stands in marked contrast. Uranus has 5 satellites moving in one plane in a common direction in nearly perfect circular orbits, and with this plane at the same time being the plane of the planet equator. Neptune, with its 2 satellites, shows a system that is very disorderly. The inner satellite is Triton, discovered by Lassell in 1846, only 17 days after the discovery of the planet. It moves in a nearly circular orbit, which, however, is tilted 20 degrees to the planet's equator. This causes the orbital plane to precess like a top. The rotation of the planet itself is retrograde, with a period of about 16 hours. The motion of Triton is likewise retrograde, that is, in the opposite sense of planetary motion in general. The second satellite, Nereid, discovered by myself in 1948, has a direction inclined only 5 degrees on the planet's orbit, but the satellite orbit is highly eccentric, its distance to Neptune varying by more than 7 times. The period of Triton is about 6 days, 5.9 to be exact. The period of Nereid, 360 days, that is nearly a year. This chaotic mechanical arrangement suggests that something very drastic has happened to the Neptune system in its early history. The peculiar orbit of Nereid suggests that while it was probably formed as a satellite of Neptune, it was temporarily lost by the planet to space and was subsequently recaptured in a direct orbit related to the Neptune orbit, but not to the direction of planetary rotation. This explanation is in common to that of 11 other irregular satellites in the solar system. That is, first the satellites being lost and then recaptured. All of these are assumed to have been first formed in the protoplanet envelopes, then lost to nearby interplanetary space as the protoplanet masses decreased and the satellites spiraled outward, and finally recaptured in subsequent close encounters. Such encounters had to occur sooner or later, owing to the intersection of the orbits of the planets and the lost satellites around the Sun. It is probable that Pluto, now an independent planet, was similarly shared by Neptune, but did not get recaptured during the lifetime of the protoplanet, that's the protoplanet Neptune. When Nereid did get recaptured, but the protoplanet was apparently no longer sufficiently dense to cause its highly elliptical capture orbit to be rounded off to a nearly circular orbit. Pluto and Triton are not very different in dimension and probably in mass. Triton may be a recaptured satellite, as I have stated, but its very nearly circular orbit suggests an alternative explanation as well. That Triton was never lost, but that its orbit was disturbed by a close passage of an intruder into the satellite system. This intruder may have been Pluto. It could have passed through without itself having been recaptured by transferring angular momentum to Triton at right angles to its orbit. This could have left the orbit essentially intact, but for the 20-degree tilt. One final remark is in order on the obliquities of the outer planets. The angles between the planetary equators and the orbital planes. As is well known, this angle is 23.5 degrees for the Earth and 25 degrees for Mars. For Jupiter, it is only 3 degrees. For Saturn, 27 degrees. For Uranus, 98 degrees. That is nearly at right angles. And for Neptune, 140 degrees. That means it was flipped over and is now retrograde. These occasional high obliquities pose an interesting dynamical problem that appears to bear on the process of planet formation, because in the present dynamical conditions, these obliquities cannot change appreciably. The early history of the solar system appears to have consisted of three periods. In the first place, a period of contraction of a pre-stellar cloud, which led to the formation of the proto-sun in the center of the system, and a flat disk of cold gas and condensate surrounding it. This disk-shaped cloud later broke up by gravitational instability into a system of protoplanets. Each protoplanet gave rise to the formation of a single planet, normally accompanied by a satellite system. In the second phase, the proto-sun at the center gradually heated up and eventually went through a phase of very high luminosity, even in excess of the present brightness of the sun. This high luminosity phase stripped the inner planets of their extensive gaseous envelopes, composed mostly of hydrogen and helium, and appreciably depleted the hydrogen and helium contents, even of the planets of intermediate size, Uranus and Neptune. The largest planets, Jupiter and Saturn, suffered the smallest losses. And then third, the geological phase, lasting till the present, during which the planets evolved mostly by their own internal processes, and when no major dynamical or physical alterations were imposed either by the sun or by other planets through perturbations. It is concluded that the obliquities attained their present magnitudes during phase two of this evolution, because solar heating and resulting mass loss by the planets could have introduced large increases in the obliquity, and on this basis the obliquities observed for the majority of the planets can be understood, but Neptune, with its retrograde rotation, requires a separate explanation. It is possible that the curious obliquities of Uranus, in particular of Neptune, result from a close stellar encounter to the solar system during its protoplanet phase, or alternatively, that the peculiar system of turbulent eddies existed in the outer portions of the solar nebula. We have seen that the satellite systems of Uranus and Neptune are opposites. In one case, perfect order, and the other case, extreme disorder. But the planets themselves are remarkably similar. The total mass of the planets, about 15 and 17 times the Earth, seems to have been responsible for this. The difference in distance to the sun seems to have been less important. The dependence on mass is attributed to the evolution of the protoplanets, which are assumed to have been essentially of solar or cosmic composition. Large protoplanets were able to produce planets of essentially solar composition, such as Jupiter and Saturn. Very small planets, small protoplanets, produced cinder-like planets, basically composed of silicates and iron, like the Earth and the other terrestrial planets, and Uranus and Neptune are intermediate. Now, a few comments about the spectra of Uranus and Neptune, which give information on the composition of the atmospheres of these planets. The spectra are extraordinarily rich in structure. Numerous very strong bands, absorption bands, are present, which increase in intensity as you go from the red part of the spectrum to the infrared. In the near infrared, these absorptions are so strong that only small islands of reflected sunlight remain. The absorptions in the orange and red cause the visual colors of these two planets, Uranus being light bluish and Neptune greenish blue. This small color difference between these two planets is due to the small differences in the red absorptions. The strongest of these absorptions in the visible part of these spectra are due to methane. They were already observed more than 100 years ago visually by Secchi in Italy and Huggins in England. More recently, of course, they have been observed photographically with increasing detail, beginning with the observations of V.M. Slipher at the Lowell Observatory in Arizona some 60 years ago. The question now arises whether the absorptions we observe are all due to methane or whether other gases can be found as well. In the case of Jupiter, we find ammonia to be present, but the temperatures of Uranus and Neptune are so low that ammonia is frozen out. Water vapor is frozen out, of course, even more thoroughly because of the low temperature. The only constituent that has been observed in addition to methane is molecular hydrogen, and this gas we would indeed expect to be present in tremendous abundance. In 1946, I found some weak absorptions in the near infrared, which were caused, as Hertzberg showed in 1952, caused by hydrogen under high pressure. Now, Jupiter and Saturn also contain large quantities of hydrogen, but the penetration into these atmospheres is limited by condensation products of ammonia, a sort of an ammonia cirrus, that causes a cloud cover on both of these planets. In the case of Jupiter and Saturn, therefore, the reflected sunlight we observe is due to these cloud covers. That is not true for Uranus and Neptune, where the ammonia cirrus is so far down in the atmosphere that the visual penetration is entirely limited by the gas content, by Rayleigh scattering. One can make an approximate model of the atmospheric composition from the data at hand, and one finds that something like 135 kilometer atmospheres of hydrogen are present on these planets, something like 370 kilometer atmospheres of helium, and 3 kilometer atmospheres of methane. Now, a few comments on the composition of the planet as a whole. The composition of Uranus and Neptune appears to be definitely different from that of the Sun and from Jupiter and Saturn, which are approximately equal in composition to the Sun, except for temperature. Recent investigations have indicated that Uranus has a rock and metal core which contributes approximately 10% of the total mass of the planet, and for Neptune the figure is about 11%, almost the same. The bulk of the planet mass is found to be in the form of ice, mostly contributed by water, that is by H2O. And then there is an outer shell of hydrogen and helium, a neon gas, which amounts to something like 16% by weight for Neptune and about 20% by weight for Uranus. These values, of course, are still somewhat provisional, but it appears that they are correct as to the general order of magnitude. So this is what is at present known about the composition of those two very distant planets.